eventually, and this was one of the first things I remember feeling, you get to want to be an American. You become ashamed that you come from this ghetto and this community. And I remember, I guess, the first signs of that with me, Ybor City being the kind of town it is defending Henry Ford's assembly line, say, from to my uncles and cousins, you know, defending capitalism to them, saying that the United States is marvelous, all of these things, you know, that the things that they were opposed to were right. I remember I was an ardent, you know, supporter of Henry Ford at the age of 12.
This in the 30s?
When I was 12, yes, yes.
In the 30s.
And for example, when you take that strike, I had one experience which left me with a kind of psychological scar, and that is I was in junior high school, and I was a member of the student patrol. Well, you know what the student patrol is. You put on an armband and so that kids pass, etc., or you stand in the stairway so that people go up and down the right way. Well, one of the things that happened during that strike was that the workers would march onto the schools to close them down, to bring the children out in these demands. And I was at a junior high school which was just really beyond Ybor City. I mean, like a block away. We had like a kind of dividing line for it, Nebraska Avenue. And I was in the student patrol, and it was not a big school with big grounds. That is, it had a high kind of fence all around it, and it was, you know, surrounded by streets, houses, a little bit of business around there, and no campus at all. So the principal, fearing that the junior, you know, they would march on the junior high school, closed all the gates and put the student patrols at these gates. And I was at one of the gates. I was, I think, in the seventh grade then, yes, in the seventh grade, in my first year of junior high. And I still remember thinking, if they come, what do I do? Because my mother, of course, was in the strike committee of one of the factories. It was an extraordinarily radical strike. The first day, the cigar makers tried to march to the city hall in Tampa with red flags, singing Avanza Pueblo, you know, the old anarchist Italian song, Avanza Pueblo, a la batalla, bandera roja.
Yeah,
Scarlet Banner. And the march, the bonus march on Washington made them feel that the revolution was here.
When did the tightness set in? When you were...
I think the tightness began to set in after 1930, because there was no such thing as any closure of factories, no immediate response to the crash that I remembered. I had an uncle who was a foreman at one of the factories. That is, he was a foreman over cigar makers, a man who was ill-equipped for his job because he couldn't bear to fire anybody. And he would discuss, you know, with his wife, we have to cut so many people, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And my aunt would say, you can't fire him, they have 12 children, you know, that kind of thing. So I'd hear a great deal of talk of that kind. And so you knew things were getting worse. And, for example, no more apprentices were taken into the cigar factories. My sister was in the last batch ever taken.
When you say sister, were they girl cigar makers?
Oh, of course. Women were in the factories.
Women?
Oh, yes. The women were very militant.
Yeah.
When the factories opened, then open and cut out workers. And there was, for example, one really hated general manager of one of the factories that began from the very beginning there, a Spaniard. As they would say, it takes a Spaniard to be that cruel to his fellow man, who stood at the top of the steps, the workers came back, and he would go, he'd hum Scarlet Banner, and he'd say, you can come in. Now, then he'd hum the International, and you can come. Nobody begged him, though.
You mean he would lay off those?
He was just simply saying, those who could come in, and then when he turned his back, everybody was left there, meant that they weren't hired. But nobody begged him.
He wouldn't hire those because they're the most militant.
Yes.
The idea.
Oh, exactly, exactly. Also, the head of the strike committee, the top strike committee for that strike, were indicted for conspiracy and went to, all of them spent a year in jail.
How long did the strike last?
The reader's strike lasted only about a couple of weeks.
Is that what it was called, the reader's strike?
Yes. Oh, yes. La huelga de los lectores.
La huelga
de los lectores. Then I speak of these big strikes. There were, of course, many little wildcat strikes.
Now, this is throughout the 30s, then, with these strikes. The reader's strike was one. Then the others lasted longer, is that it?
The previous ones, like the 1921 strike, lasted for 10 months. The 1910 strike lasted for 7 months. The first big strike of 1901 lasted about 4 or 5 months. But throughout, there would be many little wildcat strikes. Cigar makers were just incredible. If they were trying to give them worse leaf, one that would crumble on them, was too dry, they'd walk out. And when cigar makers walk out, they don't walk out at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day. They walk out after the tobacco has been to be used that day has been moistened and laid out, which means that that the manufacturer loses a few hundred dollars, in some cases thousands.
Well, when did CIO come in? When did the cigar makers?
CIO, why? After the reader's strike, I remember one of my older cousins going around in a very secretive manner. You would think what he was planning was the assassination of the Tsar, trying to get to sign up people for the CIO, because the international of the AFL was always very conservative, was always considered a kind of enemy. They would, I think only in the case of 1921, ever help the strikers, ever gave it any international support. The reader strike, of course, was considered, the work of agitators. At that time, there were some people who belonged to the union that was affiliated to the international, but not a lot. The AFL had, very bad reputation with most workers, particularly with the militant workers. And so they tried to get into the CIO. The CIO never accepted, they just weren't ready for them. There were some organizers sent down by the CIO, but it was never successful as organization.
What finally happened?
There was too much hunger, really.
Too much?
There was just too much, too few jobs. The inability to organize had to do with that.
What finally happened?
By 1939, later than that, at the beginning of the war, there was union recognition, AFL, strictly bread and butter union. Everybody says, some union. Now we have, we have closed shop now. It doesn't matter,
Right. But WPA, I'm interested in this.
People would put it off as much as possible. When somebody went to WPA, it was a terrible thing. Well, that didn't mean that you didn't accept another thing. And there was, it's a big joke. There was literally no Saturday at any cigar factory at which collections weren't being done to help somebody. Or, for example, when the Havana cigar makers would go on strike, a matter of honor, you sent money to them. As a matter of fact, in 1910, 1921, the Havana cigar makers used to send money to the Tampa cigar makers for food. And yet everybody would eat grits, and there would be canteens set up to keep people going.
So most of the kids of the cigar makers, the people in the Ybor City, didn't go to high school.
Not then.
Right,
not
in the they go right to the factories.
They would go into the factories, jobs of all kinds, or go to New York. And the Depression was you went to New York, that bus fare to New York, and you joined somebody in New York, In New York, we stayed all together. We had an apartment that the only place people didn't sleep in was the kitchen. It was a six-room apartment, and my God, even in the foyer there was a bed. And people would show up from Tampa, and you'd put them up, a couple of nights, and get them a job, that kind of thing. We were the Puerto Rican immigration of that time. In any cafeteria, in the kitchen, the dishwashers, the busboys, all of that, you're bound to find at least two from Tampa, from Ybor City. And it's very difficult to talk about without making it sound like poverty's nice. It has to do with Florida, in that it's that it's open, you know, that it isn't dark satanic mills. And those streets are not, you know, like a city ghetto, you know, with tenements, that kind of thing. Oh, there were very poor houses, you know. Say a row there where they hadn't been painted for years and years. But, you know, it was out in the open, sunlight, and you played out in the streets and empty lots, all of that. It's very different. And I don't remember really deprivation. What I remember is psychological deprivation, you know, and that had to do with the way the Americans felt about us.